Chapter 30. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 10. Faces in a crowd. We hear them arriving outside, the distant rumble of the press coming to life outside the hospital entrance, questions, endless, greedy questions. The scrum and jostle outside sounds like no more than a polite murmur from here, now that we've moved to the quiet of the visitor's room. There's a tap on the door, and I rise from my seat as Nick Dunning pops his head around it. They're just making their way up. Should be with you shortly. The Met have asked that their social worker be present to take notes. Is that okay?
That's not a problem. Thank you, Nick. We're ready whenever they are.
He nods efficiently, his eyes gliding to Matthew in the seating area to double check. Satisfied with what he sees, he gives another nod and leaves. I look to Matthew. He offers me a wan smile. I give him one back. Then, as I watch him bring a plastic cup of water to his lips, I notice the slight tremor in his hand. And suddenly, for the first time, the idea that Matthew might actually be Benjamin Taylor seems a reality. I remind myself of his extraordinary levels of self-control. It occurs to me that Matthew might not be telling me everything he remembers. The scan was only yesterday, but a lot can come back in a day. He might be starting to remember things. This could be who he is. He catches my eye and I start to speak, but as I do, the visitor's room door opens. Mrs. Taylor is a dignified, calm, and beautifully dressed woman in her 60s. She holds Mr. Taylor's hand tight in hers. Eyes flutter wordlessly over faces. Introductions happen in the awkward way one would expect, and after the initial shock of meeting, everyone settles into a seat. Mr. Taylor's eyes wander, wet with emotion, while Mrs. Taylor's pale blue gaze does not leave Matthew. I watch him carefully now too. The social worker, a beat behind, noisily takes a stool and pulls out a large file from a bag to take her notes. Her expression is grim, and she avoids my eyes. Mrs. Taylor speaks first, very gently. "Do you recognise us, dear?" she asks hopefully. Mr. Taylor looks away, clenching his hands. He doesn't look like a healthy man. I'd guess at high cholesterol and blood pressure, judging by his ruddy cheeks and reddened nose. But of course, drink could be involved as well. And who could blame him? Matthew's gaze flickers over the hunched Mr. Taylor before settling back on Mrs. Taylor. He takes a moment, choosing his words carefully.
No, I don't. But then I don't recognise anyone, really, I'm afraid. He smiles apologetically, at least not at the moment. His eyes connect with mine. We both know what he just said isn't true. He does recognise someone. He recognises me. And it suddenly occurs to me what that must mean to him. To recognise someone in a world of strangers, I'm the only person he seems to recognise. But how?
But you remember the house, son? Mr. Taylor raises his head. Our house. Everything that happened before
The air in the room changes at Mr. Taylor's use of the word son. The social worker's ears prick up. Matthew hesitates. There's so much weight in what these people are asking from the situation. I could see Matthew's thoughts whirring. What should he say? Is he Benjamin? If he were to come to that realization right here, right now, I can't even imagine how terrifying that would be. To know that terrible things might have been done to you, but for you to have no memory of those things, decades lost, or to have it all rush back in an instant. I realise I shouldn't have let Matthew do this, even though he wanted to. He needs to remember at his own speed. Triggering too much could cause another panic attack. He may be desperate for a past, but perhaps Benjamin's past isn't a past worth going back to. Whatever happened to Benjamin Taylor after he vanished couldn't have been good. Matthew answers with a lightness of touch that makes my heart ache. Sorry, but I don't remember a house, any house. If I'm honest with you, I don't remember much of anything before I was found on that beach.
I remember what's happened over the last 10 days, but that's about it at the moment. His answer is kind, but there's a finality to it. How could there not be? Right now he has nothing to give them. There's only future stretching out ahead of him. The Taylors stare at him, lost, unclear where the conversation should go next. They begin to realise, after all their years of searching, that the prize they were fighting for might have changed so utterly that he may now just be a stranger who doesn't even recognise them. Mr. Taylor speaks first, breaking the flat silence, trying to infuse it with the magic they thought they would find here.
You look just like him, you know? Our Benji.
He means you look just how he might have looked, his wife corrects him gently.
Yes, yes. He was only, well, 12 when he left, you know.
Mr. Taylor gives a forced smile before turning to elicit help with the floundering exchange, first from me and then from the police social worker.
Doc, what do you think? Sue? Do you think we might be onto something here?
He falters, because what can he say? Is Matthew ours? Is this one finally our Benjamin? I look to the social worker, but she remains mute, her expression a dumb show of empathy.
Excellent. Well, that's helpful. Thanks a bunch, Sue.
I grasp the untethered conversation. It's hard to say, Mr. Taylor. All we can do really is wait. There was a chance that Matthew might have recognised you immediately and then we would have known. However, I'm not sure that's happened. But memory is a complex system. I think perhaps Matthew just needs time and hopefully things should start to come back to him. And once they do, we should be in a better position to know.
Of course, of course. I don't want to rush anything.
Mr. Taylor is piteously quick to agree. I notice Matthew's gaze drift away to the window. Jesus, God knows what's going on in his mind. His energy has dwindled, though, that much is clear. He can't keep this up anymore. He doesn't recognise these people. I'm still the only person in this room who he recognises. This is a dead end. I make a decision. I think what would probably be best is if we finished up here for today. We should hear back on the DNA match by later this afternoon, and if it's a fit, then we can check back in a couple of weeks and see where Matthew is in terms of recovery by then, if that works for you both. There's a heavy pause while neither Taylor answers, so I dive back in. I know it's not the outcome any of us wanted today, but what's important now is Matthew's recovery and giving him the time he needs to adjust. Mrs. Taylor sits up straighter in her chair. Yes, yes, Doctor, you're quite right, she says. I can see in her eyes she's already trying to work out what they'll tell everyone outside, everyone back home, the people on TV. Just another false alarm. 27 years of false alarms. Let's go, Jim. Come on, she says, sliding her hand into one of his and giving it a little squeeze. He looks into her eyes, lost for a moment until she smiles at him. The bravery and selflessness of that smile breaking my heart. They leave us with promises of more contact to come. At least that will be the official line when they reach the press outside, but I think we all know in our hearts this is the end of Matthew's role in the Taylors' lives. Matthew isn't their son. Watching them walk hand in hand down the corridor, I find myself hoping they find it in themselves to stop searching, and finally carve out their own little piece of life in the time remaining. When I turn back to Matthew, he's watching me. He holds my gaze silently for a long while, a calmness settling back between us as the Taylor's footsteps recede. A sad smile breaks across his face, and he gives me the tiniest shake of his head. He doesn't know them. He isn't their son. I think of the real Benjamin, out there, somewhere, whether he's a lost 40-year-old man or a 12-year-old in a shallow grave. Either way, I hope he's at peace. I walk back to join Matthew and follow his gaze as he watches the couple clear the corner at the end of the corridor. It's okay, I tell him. They'll be fine. You did a really good thing, Matthew. Why don't you head back to the ward and get some rest? You deserve it,
I say. Back in my office, I call Peter. I need to find out why the hell this fiasco was ever allowed to happen in the first place. Why a meeting was scheduled before DNA results were confirmed.
I can only apologise.
Peter can only apologise. And seeing the 5 missed calls from him on my mobile, I'm inclined to believe that he did do everything within his power to stop the Met from wading in without medical consent.
I wasn't informed of their sudden interest in the case until this afternoon, Emma. If I had been, this would have gone through the appropriate channels instead of the less than ideal scenario we now find ourselves in.
This is the most agitated I've ever heard, Peter. He pauses to regain composure.
I tried to contact you, but I imagine you were already in the thick of it there. I'm so sorry, Emma.
It's fine, Peter, honestly. Matthew was happy to meet them. It wasn't ideal, but I think there's no harm done. But then I remember the press lurking outside. Is there a line we should be taking with the media? It's not looking like Matthew is related to the Taylors. I'm guessing the DNA match will come back negative.
I think it's best to stick to no comment for now, Emma. I'll be liaising with someone at the Met this afternoon, and you can be assured that it will be them and not the hospital taking responsibility for this unfortunate line of inquiry. Let the Met release a statement first.
Peter sighs.
As they say, if the job was easy.
I remember my promise to Joe. I'm supposed to resign now. I promised. I dealt with this fresh crisis, and now I should stop. I should say something to Peter. But instead I think of Matthew's look to me in the visitor's room earlier. He didn't recognise the Taylors, but he recognised me. I don't know how he knows me, but he knows me. Who I am. My secrets, things I've been at pains to forget for so long. I'll never know if I leave now. And just like that, the moment to say something passes.
So, how did the fMRI go yesterday?
Peter continues oblivious.
Anything interesting we should know about?
I shake off thoughts of leaving and of Joe, and I slip with worrying fluidity back into work mode. The scan was helpful. I'm still working on the images, but it doesn't look like his hippocampus is engaging on anything prior to the day he was found. I'll wait to write it up, but between you and me, it's a verifiable fugue.
Ha! Very interesting. That's, well, good for you. Keep me posted if you need anything. You know where I am.
I don't mention Matthew's reaction to the final fMRI question. Have you killed? I don't mention him knowing my name. I don't mention how strangely close I'm beginning to feel to him. And I certainly don't mention my reason for staying. Because every one of those admissions would be grounds enough for me to be taken off this case. That evening, Matthew and I work through some memory exercises in his room. Simple card images testing the boundaries between his knowledge and his memory. While he recognises a picture of the Eiffel Tower, he struggles to remember if he's ever seen it with his own eyes. I explain that triggering is all we can do at this stage. I prescribe an anti-anxiety medication to counter any panic induced by our potential triggering, and then we call it a day. Taking the lift down to the lobby, I remember the gauntlet awaiting me outside. The trucks, the microphones, the questions. Dread slowly rises inside me as memories of similar crowds crawl back into my mind. The bodies pushing, snatching, their graphic, unfeeling questions, the vitriol. Hemmed in by their desperate animal need to know everything, the endless, insistent, nasty hows, wheres, whys, the desire to pull apart the gristle of our lives as they rooted around for something elusive, something unknowable, a reason. The lift doors open and my pulse soars as the scale of the crowd outside comes into view. There are so many more vans than earlier, and a more substantial barrier has been erected around the entrance, a press pit behind it. It's dizzying. There's a blast of red brake lights outside as a car manoeuvres in the packed car park. I brace myself against the lift handrail as an image flashes through my mind. Blood on my hands. 14 years ago, blood, cracked and dried, a reddish brown across my palms, caught under my fingernails. His blood. I'd find it there for days. I shudder. Someone must have alerted the crews outside that I was on my way out of the building because their cameras are already up, microphones poised and ready. I can already hear their shouted questions. I repeat in my head Peter's instructions to me. No comment. No comment. As if, in the heat of the moment, I might somehow forget my line. The security guards by the sliding doors nod as I head towards them, my heart pounding in my throat, my mouth dry. Outside, there are the logos of American news networks alongside the British ones now. I suppose everyone loves a happy ending, a reunited family. Except, of course, we haven't given them one. We haven't given them anything yet. One of the security guards steps forward. Would you like us to escort you to your car, Dr. Lewis? I don't recognise him, but he knows who I am, and I'm guessing he knows how far away I'm parked. Oh, God, yes, thank you. That would be fantastic. Thank you. I notice the quiver in my voice. As he leads me through the doors, the squall of questions begins. He opens an umbrella overhead, shielding me from them, as well as from the snow. The winter air hits my hot cheeks and cools them as we plough ahead. Then, in the crowd, I see a flash of red hair, a face I instantly recognise. It takes me a second to realise that I only know her from a photograph, though, Chris's wife. Zarapul's hair is pulled back, slickly, in a fashionably low bun, her dictaphone ready in her hand. Her expression changes as her gaze finds mine, her smile slipping from her face. I hadn't realised she was press. We lock eyes only for an instant. There's something disconcerting in the way she's staring. It's not that she recognises me from school, it's not that, it's something else. And it frightens me. Chapter 31. The Man. Day 11. Buried. That night Matthew has a dream. A dream so real he cannot clear it from his mind on waking. In the dream he is alone in the ward garden. Everything is so real in this dream. The scent of the plants and the malty earth, the soft rain and the rustle of the trees. He somehow knows his memory has returned, though he does not know what that is. He sits quietly, contented in the garden, and closes his eyes. He lets the breeze play across his face, but slowly he becomes aware of a sound, and his eyes flicker open. The new noise is coming to him from deep inside the landscaped bushes and shrubs of the hospital garden. It is a constant scraping noise. Scraping, scratching. Scratch, scratch, scratch. He cannot ignore it. He rises from the stone bench and looks around the garden. There is no one there. He cannot see where the noise is coming from, but it sounds like digging. A creature digging in the mud. The sound makes him shudder. It seems to be coming from the bushes behind the stone bench. He looks around to see if anyone has come out to the garden and heard it, but as he looks up at the windows surrounding the garden, he notices that there is no one anywhere. It's almost as if the whole hospital were abandoned, with only him remaining. It is just him and the horrible scratching. He looks back towards the bushes where the sound is coming from. It grows louder, more insistent, like a rat trapped behind a skirting board. It scares him to think what it may be, back there, what he'll see if he looks. But the noise continues, and he knows there is only one way to stop it. He steps towards it, going behind the bench and pushing through the fronds of foliage. He pushes on deeper into the dark branches. And then he sees him. A man, kneeling, half hidden, digging in the undergrowth. The man does not look up at Matthew. He just keeps digging, head bowed, scrabbling and clawing with bare hands in the mud. He is burying something. Something small. Something important. There is something important buried in the garden. The back of the man's head is dripping with blood.
The digging man is so focused on his task he doesn't seem to have noticed his terrible wound. Matthew knows this, because the man is him.
Matthew wakes, sweating. The clock in his room reads 4:39. He sits bolt upright in the dark, his heart pounding, listening for the sounds of the hospital around him. He's not sure if the dream means something, or if he should just go back to sleep. Was it a memory, distorted by dreams, or just a nightmare?
Dr. Lewis warned him that the memory exercises they worked on might trigger connections. He recalls the noise in the dream, the noise in the darkness behind the plants, insistent, and he squeezes his eyes shut. Moments later, he's out of bed, pulling on his shoes and the puffer jacket Rhoda gave him. He slips from the shadows of his room into the brightly lit corridor, makes his way tentatively past the empty nurse's station and down towards the ward garden. He ducks smoothly into the toilets as a care assistant passes. He waits and then heads on. The door to the snow-encrusted garden is propped open for night shift smokers, so he slips out easily into the night. He's certain now that there will be something there, hidden in the earth. Answers, maybe. When he reaches the stone bench, he stops, shivering, the dizzying feeling from his dream returning. He looks up at the sky, clear and starry above, his breath clouding in the air, and he suddenly doubts himself. He thinks of the progress he's making, of Emma, beautiful Emma, of how she wants to help him. Of how she held him, how she's trying to fix him. Perhaps he should go back to bed, curl up in the darkness and the warmth and wait for things to become clear. Every day things seem to be getting clearer. He watches, mesmerised, as the frost-glittered plant fronds behind the stone bench sway in the night breeze. It can't hurt to look behind there, can it? He pushes his way into the icy foliage, listening carefully for the sound of anyone approaching from the ward. Just like in the dream, he finds a small clearing behind the bushes. Kneeling on the ground, hidden from sight, he starts to move the soft dirt aside, scraping at the mud with his fingers. Perhaps it was just a dream, he decides. Perhaps I really am going mad after all. He claws deeper, and then his nails hit plastic. Half a foot down, a Ziploc bag in the soil, he stops suddenly, stunned to have actually found something. He looks around, listening, but there is only the distant bleeping of call buzzers, the breeze in the laden trees. He looks down at the small plastic bag, at the glint of metal inside. He doesn't know what it means yet, not exactly, or how it got here. But it seems like the first step towards finding out. Someone put this here for him. He pulls it loose from the crumbly soil and slips it into his jacket. Chapter 32. Zara Pool. Day 11. Ahead of the game. Zara Pool is driving along the coastal road between Wells and Holcombe at 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning, on her way to doorstep Emma Lewis. The address Zara was given by her contact at the hospital was odd. A house off the main road, essentially in the middle of nowhere. She expected Dr. Lewis to be closer to the hospital. That would have seemed more logical. But this address doesn't. Not to someone who knows the area. But then, something is off about all of this, as far as Zara is concerned. Her contact at the hospital, a porter she'd been slipping money to, had been pretty accurate so far. He'd informed her, prior to anyone else knowing, that the new doctor would be coming, although she hadn't had quite enough time to make any real impact with the knowledge. But the next text she'd received from him, 3 days later, had been pure gold. The porter had texted her at 3 a.m. on Thursday, the same night Chris had received that text from Emma. The bright light of Zara's phone had briefly illuminated their dark bedroom, Chris sleeping peacefully beside her. It said, "He's talking. He's British. No memory." A flash of joy cut through the disappointment of Chris's text, because finally she had her story. She was the first to get it, which meant she had something that other people would want.
She quietly slipped out of bed, grabbed some clothes and headed down to the kitchen. She typed up a page of copy, fresh coffee standing by, and then she'd made some calls. Not to the local paper she was currently working for, but to contacts she'd been working on for a while. She had new information on Mr. Nobody. She hadn't come up with the name herself, the mail had, but everyone was using it. And she could send through her piece if they were interested in running it. It was source verified. If needs be, she could even give her source's name. She knew she could easily get another one at Princess Margaret's. Who didn't like free money? She sold the story once, and then again, and again, and by daybreak, when she was pretty much the sole reporter in the country covering the story, she'd grabbed some toast and headed straight into the storm brewing down at the Princess Margaret Hospital. By mid-morning, a whole new swarm of journalists had descended, eager to find out what Mr. Nobody was finally saying now he could talk. The story was gaining momentum, with newscasters and networks from other countries jostling alongside the crews she was already starting to recognise. Which was fantastic as far as Zara was concerned. There was more than enough to go around, and she was getting article requests from papers and magazines she'd never even heard of, across Europe and now America too. Her preparation had finally paid off. That was 3 days ago, but it was yesterday that things really kicked off. Zara had simply asked Chris at breakfast, not for the first time, if there had been any breakthroughs since Mr. Nobody had started talking. Apparently he's not making much sense at the moment. We've been asked by the hospital to defer questioning him again until he starts remembering. His doctor doesn't want to run the risk of regressing his recovery at this stage, Chris had told her. He hadn't mentioned the text he'd received from Dr. Lewis. He hadn't brought any of that up. Not the list of school staff she'd asked him for either. And he certainly hadn't mentioned asking her out for a drink. So neither had Zara. But then a call had come through on her iPhone, and she'd slipped out into the garden to take it. It was her contact at the hospital. The call was rushed and muffled, clearly made in haste. The Metropolitan Police had just arrived at the hospital. Something big was happening. Either Chris was keeping more things from her, or the Met hadn't even told the local police what was happening. A family were on their way to the hospital to ID Mr. Nobody. The Taylors, the parents of missing Benjamin Taylor. The press were prepped and ready when the Taylors arrived because of her. That's why they'd known the right questions to ask. As the couple breezed past them without stopping, they got their pictures, they got their no comments, but most importantly, they got their articles. And then an hour later, they got even more. Mr. Nobody wasn't Benjamin Taylor. The text she received made that very clear. Again, Zara heard it first. The porter had been in the corridor after the meeting. He'd stood back and watched as Mrs. Taylor gave a sad little shake of her head in answer to D.C. Barker's question. Matthew wasn't their son. Zara watched Emma leaving the hospital last night. She'd been ready. She'd seen her before, of course, the day she arrived at the hospital when Mike pointed her out as they stood in the coffee shop queue. She'd thought at the time she looked interesting, smart, and reassuringly out of place. Zara had always felt slightly out of place too, and she recognised the look in others. But last night, with her chestnut hair caught in the wind, cheeks rosy from the camera flashes and flurry of shouts around her, she'd looked beautiful, Zara had to admit. She hated herself for bringing it down to that, but she could understand why Chris might find her attractive, although the idea of it made her stomach lurch with heartbreaking apprehension. The thoughts started spiralling out of her grasp. Her Chris, with a doctor from London, a beautiful, clever, rich doctor, her Chris. A possessiveness she didn't realise she was capable of feeling bristled hard inside her. Zara had just stood and stared until their eyes had locked. And Emma had looked back at her, haunted, before disappearing into the night. That's when Zara made her decision. Zara would find out who Emma was. For the story, of course. She would ask her, woman to woman, what was going on with the case, why was she here, and maybe, just maybe, Emma's connection with Chris would make sense. Maybe everything was actually okay.
Zara pulls off the main road and down onto the snow-covered drive of Cuckoo Lodge, wincing at the noise her tyres make on the gravel. Obviously, it's not meant to be a stealth mission, but the element of surprise does tend to help when someone is opening their front door to a stranger. There's the chance, of course, that Emma Lewis could just slam the door in her face. At the end of the drive, Zara pushes her car door closed as quietly as she can and looks up at the house.
Cute, she thinks. She can understand why Emma chose this place. She makes her way through the snow-covered picket gate up to the gabled front door and knocks. The sound echoes through the empty house. She waits, then tries again, harder. No sound within but echoes, outside the wind through the trees and the occasional burst of birdsong. She bends now, pushing open the letterbox.
Hello? Dr. Lewis?
No reply.
It's Zara Poole. I was wondering if we could talk.
She hopes she doesn't sound angry, or desperate, or pathetic, or like a crazy girlfriend or a wronged wife looking for an argument, because that's not what she is. That's not why she's here. Chris can do what he likes with his life, she reasons. If he'd rather be with someone else, there's not really anything she can do about that, is there? You can't make people love you, she knows that. And Zara doesn't want to be one of those people. A scorned wife, a victim, the one left behind. So, best not to rail against it. Best to take it on the chin. Keep her cards close and see how the game plays out. She's just here for her story, she tells herself. Once she's got the story, she'll go.
Zara straightens up and looks into the darkened windows. No one's in. She turns to look back at the drive, and then she notices the doctor's little grey car is nowhere to be seen. She must have already left for the hospital. Zara pauses. She casts her eyes down the gravel driveway, weighing up her options. She looks back at the empty house.
If she does this, she thinks, she might be able to get away with it. She would definitely be able to hear someone coming down that long gravel drive. She'd certainly have enough time to get out if she goes in. She tries the front door handle. It pivots all the way down under her hand, but the door does not budge. Locked. She smiles wryly to herself. Of course it's locked. Nobody leaves their front door unlocked, not even in Norfolk. She turns to leave, then changes her mind. She goes around to the back of the house and tugs at the patio door. It won't budge. She doubles back to the side of the house. Low to the ground, there's a long, thin window. A basement window. She crouches to peer in. A dim utility room beyond. She gives the corner of the window a swift tug and nicks a nail. Locked. She sucks her finger to dampen the smarting and thinks about what to do next. Suddenly, concerned, she scans high along the eaves of the house for a security camera. Nothing. Stepping back from the small window, she thinks of her options. She can just see around the side of the building to her car from here. The drive remains otherwise empty. She makes up her mind and swiftly walks up to the window, cautiously looking both ways, before cocking her right foot back and kicking as hard as she can. The smash is loud and satisfying. She braces herself for a burglar alarm, but no siren sounds. She nudges out the remaining loose shards with a heeled boot before leaning forward to check the hole. Inside the house is quiet. Zara dusts off her trench coat and scans the dark utility room. She doesn't really know what she's looking for. She's never done anything like this before. But she knows she needs to find something, and it almost definitely won't be in the utility room. She heads up the basement stairs, gently lifting the stable door latch from the inside and stepping into the immaculate kitchen. Still no alarm sounds. If she can just find something, anything to help explain what's going on, why this woman is here, who she is, and how she knows Chris. Zara takes in the Victorian kitchen, agar, full fruit bowls, fresh flowers in vases,
and wonders when the doctor actually has time to do all of this. Who has time to work and do all this? Perhaps the house is serviced, because it's perfect, so effortlessly perfect. She tears her gaze away and wanders on through the living room populated by deep sofas and expensive rugs. But thankfully, it's messier in here. A soft cashmere throw is tossed haphazardly on the sofa, a smudged wine glass on the floor beneath, a tannin stain chalky inside, a dirty plate. So Dr. Lewis is human after all. And then Zara sees it, a glint, the edge of something poking out from under the rich fawn of the throw, the matte silver sheen of it. She reaches down and pulls it out. Emma's laptop. Zara sits down on the sofa next to it, one hand resting lightly on its smooth brushed metal lid. If she does this, then there's no going back, she thinks. But then she's already come this far. She's already broken into someone's home. What difference would looking make? Still, she hesitates. She might find something she doesn't like. There could be emails from Chris, more messages. What if looking through her laptop somehow changes everything? She would have to go home to Chris knowing but not being able to say. No. It's better to look, she decides. Yes, better to know. She flips the lid and spins the laptop around to face her. It opens to desktop, the tab open on the last page Emma looked at. Chris's Facebook page. Zara's heart skips a beat. Her jaw hardens. She minimizes the screen and pulls up Emma's iMessages. She scrolls to Chris's name and reads, "Sorry to text so late. Would it be possible to get a list of past employees at Waltham House? I can't say why just yet, but I think it might be helpful. Also, I might have to rain check that drink. Snowed under, pun intended. Emma, kiss." "No problem. Totally understand. I'll get on it and let you know ASAP. And I just want to say, it was great to see you today, Mon. Chris, kiss." "It's Emma, Chris. Kiss." "Shit, sorry. Kiss." Zara stares at the screen, frowning. She reads the messages again, tries to make sense of them. She sits in stillness for a moment and then pulls up Google. She types, "Marn Lewis," and taps search. Nothing. She tries, "Dr. Marn Lewis," and taps search. Nothing. She tries, "Marn, Norfolk." The search autocorrects to "Marnie, Norfolk," and below it, pages and pages of search results appear. Marnie Beaufort. The Beaufort family. Christ. Zara catches her breath. Holy shit. A giggle of pure joy bubbles out of her beautifully screen-lit face because, finally, Zara cannot believe her luck. Chapter 33. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 11. People are coming. The call comes at 10:07 that night. Up until then, it had been a comparatively uneventful day of memory exercises and talking through Matthew's response to his anti-anxiety medication. The lack of drama making me feel my decision not to resign yesterday had been the right one. Joe had been less understanding when I tried to explain on the phone, but it would have been crazy to leave without knowing how Matthew had come to know so much about me, so much about my father. But of course, I couldn't tell Joe my reasoning in that respect. If he'd wanted me to leave before, he'd have dragged me off himself if he knew my reasons for staying. I spent the rest of the day at the hospital, finishing Matthew's preliminary medical report and fMRI analysis. I emailed it across to Richard Groves at MIT for his opinion, and I sent it on to Peter, of course. The report included my initial observations, as well as all Matthew's scans and test results. Richard's opinion, though obviously not essential, would be extremely useful to me at this stage. Back at the lodge, I crack open another bottle of wine and heat some pasta.
I'm eating when the lodge phone rings, which is a surprise as I wasn't aware the lodge had a landline. I find it by the window next to the armchair.
Emma, has anyone contacted you?
It's Peter Chorley, his tone urgent, brusque. About what, Peter? I ask, momentarily confused by the question. Is Matthew okay?
Yes, this isn't about Matthew, Emma. Has anyone from the press contacted you in the last few hours?
There's concern for me in his voice. Something has happened. No, should they have? Sorry, Peter, what's going on? You're scaring me. I suddenly feel like I've wandered out onto the ledge in my sleep, my vertigo kicking in without a stimulus. He's silent on the line. I hear him exhale and cover his receiver. A muffled conversation. When he comes back on the line, his tone is grim.
Listen, Emma, I need you to turn your mobile phone off, please. We're sending a police officer around to you now. They'll stay outside your accommodation for the night to...
What the hell is going on, Peter? I interrupt, cutting him off mid-flow. There's another thick silence before he answers.
They found out who you are, Emma. The press. We don't know if they know where you're staying, but best to be safe. I have a contact at the Press Association. He called me 5 minutes ago. It's going to break online at midnight, and it'll be all over tomorrow's national papers.
He pauses to let me take this in before continuing.
I'm truly sorry this has happened, Emma. This isn't what anyone wanted.
I stare unseeing out into the darkness through the window. This can't be happening.
Emma, are you still there?
It's going to happen all over again, just like before. I sit down hard into the deep armchair. Yes, I manage. I need to keep him talking. I don't want him to hang up. I don't want to be left alone with this just yet. How did they find out? It seems like the next reasonable question. How could they have found out without breaking the law, without hacking data?
I don't know. We're looking into it. It was some local reporter, apparently. That's all I can tell you at the moment.
Zara. It must be Zara. Her face last night outside the hospital. Chris must have told her who I was. That's why she looked at me that way. Right. Okay. I hear myself say. Thanks for letting me know. Then I remember something. Sorry, Peter, what were you saying about the police? Why are the police coming? Am I in any danger here? The last thing I want is Chris showing up, but I'm suddenly perilously aware of how isolated I am out here.
Yes, the police are on their way. They're making arrangements. You should have someone with you within 30 minutes. It's only a precaution, obviously, but there are some concerns that the press might have information about your whereabouts. Obviously, the Beaufort case is going to attract a substantial amount of public attention as well. We're just concerned about your safety, and in light of your need to enter the Protected Persons Programme 14 years ago, it would be wise, I think, to be prepared. Better to be over-prepared than under.
Oh God, this is actually happening. I throw my mind back to that autumn 14 years ago. The threats, the letters, the hateful words sprayed on the walls of the places they put us. People grabbing at us, shoving us, their faces distorted with anger, baying for a kind of justice that we couldn't give them, Joe and Mum and me. I wonder if I hadn't said what I'd said back then, they would have chased us so hard. If I'd kept my mouth shut, they'd have hated us less. They thought we were lying, that he was still alive somewhere out there. They thought we knew where he was. They wanted the truth, even if we weren't entirely sure of it ourselves.
Emma, did you hear me?
Sorry, Peter, what?
The police officers. They should be there soon. But in the meantime, it would be best not to answer the door, not to anybody, until the police arrive. And turn off your mobile. Stay clear of this landline now, too, unless you see it's my number I'm calling from now, okay? Hopefully we're still slightly ahead of the game here.
He sounds confident, but I know what's coming. If I need police protection, this is going to get very ugly. I suddenly feel so incredibly alone. Alone in the woods, alone in my life.
I'll call you first thing tomorrow morning, if not before. Trust me, Emma, it's all going to be fine in the long run.
The line goes dead. And I sit in silence, my heart beating loud in my ears. They're coming for me. I pull out my mobile and slide off the power, just as Peter told me. Outside the windows, I can make out the glint of snowflakes falling, and beyond that, the darkness of the dense forest surrounding me. I'm a sitting duck in this isolated house. I head to the front door, deadbolting it. If any doorsteppers get this far, they'll get no further. I try not to think who else might want to pay me a visit now that the news of who I am is breaking. I head to the patio doors, tugging hard at the handle until I'm certain it's locked and secure. I pull the heavy tapestry curtains closed across the great expanse of black outside and shiver. I dash to the kitchen sink and lean over, pulling on the bobbled rope of the blind until the outside world disappears behind it. I pull the curtains tight in the living room and the hallway and then run up the stairs to check the windows and close the curtains in the two bedrooms. I know that even a tiny gap in the fabric is enough for a long-lens camera and a photographer with enough patience. When it's all done, and I know everything is secure, I slump down on the top step and catch my breath. Is everything locked? What am I forgetting? And that's when I hear it. The crunch of a footstep outside on the gravel. Already? I hold my breath, listening hard. Shit, the police won't be here for half an hour. It could be a reporter, a photographer, or it could be someone else. We didn't leave 14 years ago because of the media alone. We left for our own safety. I think of the house phone lying downstairs on the armchair, my iPhone next to it turned off. I listen for another footstep. Nothing. Just the pop of the fire downstairs. I stand and start to take the stairs down, wincing at every creak. Outside, a fox shrieks in the distance, and I pause as the plaintive call echoes out through the woods. But no sound of footsteps. Perhaps they've headed round the back. If I can make it into the living room, I can grab my iPhone, and then I can run back upstairs and lock myself in the bedroom. I can call the police from there. I continue down the stairs, holding my breath. And then I hear the footsteps in the gravel again. Two steps this time. Someone turning, right by the front door. I freeze. And then the knocking starts. 3 heavy pounds on the door. Oh, please. God, no. I stand frozen mid-step and watch as the door handle moves, rattling against the lock. And then I run. I bolt down the stairs, run to the sofa, and dive for my mobile. The screen flashes white. I hear the footsteps outside. Whoever it is on the move. They could easily burst through the thin Victorian windows. I abandon my iPhone, which is still powering up, and grab the house phone as I dart into the kitchen and head for the patio doors. I could make a run for it into the woods behind the house. I could double back on myself through the trees, make a break for the car, and head to the hospital. At least there's security there. But I remember my car keys are still on the ledge in the front hall. Shit. I can't hear the footsteps anymore. Then right next to me, behind the curtain, a loud bang on the patio doors. I shoot away from them, my heart thundering. Someone's right there. And then a man's voice comes furious and gruff. I know you're in there, Marnie. Open the fucking door. I retreat further back into the kitchen until my back comes up hard against the basement door. I'll be safe down there. Gently, I raise the latch and ease the door open, peering down into the darkness below. A chill wells up from the basement. I leave the door ajar enough to shed some light down the stairwell, but I leave the lights off. I don't want to attract his attention. Feeling my way down each cold stone step, I creep into the darkness. At the bottom of the stairs, I make a break towards the airing cupboard on the far side of the room. As I dash across the open space, a brutally sharp stab of pain shoots up through my foot, then another. I fly forward, landing hard, sprawling across the basement floor. Pain thunders through my hands now as they connect with the sharp objects littering the floor. I try to muffle my reaction, but I can't help but cry out at the sheer intensity of it. Raw with wounds, I curl tight into a fetal position. The pain is everywhere. I hold a hand up to the half-light and see the dark, wet marks blossom across my palms. Blood. My eyes slowly adjust to the darkness, and I see the floor around me is glittering with bright slivers of broken glass caught in the moonlight. I try to stumble to my feet, but let out a moan of agony and drop back down. Above me, through the smashed basement window, 2 booted feet appear, and I'm suddenly blinded. A flashlight, I think. I squint up into its glare. The man's voice comes again.
What the hell are you doing down there, Marn? Why aren't you answering your sodding phone?
I tried to shield my eyes from the glare of the probing flashlight to see the face above me, but as I do, he must catch sight of my bleeding hands.
Jesus Christ, Marn, you're bleeding. Are you okay? Wait, just stay right there. Don't move. I'll jump down.
Chris? I ask, bewildered.
Yeah, of course. Who did you think it was?
There are basically only two police officers around here. A big, tall figure drops down through the broken window into the basement next to me with a grunt.
Oh, God. Listen, don't move. Shit, there's glass everywhere.
What's going on, Chris? Why the hell did you break my window?
Chapter 34. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 11. Walking on broken glass. It was Zara, wasn't it? He looks up from my foot, tweezers in hand.
I don't know, he answers thoughtfully. You mean who broke the window? Or your cover?
My bleeding feet rest on a towel-covered cushion on his lap as he delicately removes each splinter of glass. Chris carried me up from the basement to put me on the sofa before he headed off to find a first aid kit for my wounds.
Did you tell her who I was? I ask.
He looks up at me, his feelings clearly hurt.
What? No, of course not. Why would you think that?
He holds my foot firmly in his hand now and pulls.
Ah, Jesus, Chris! Are you nearly done?
Oh, this hurts so much.
Don't be such a baby. He smiles, amused. I can't believe you thought I was coming to get you. That's hilarious.
He catches my expression.
Oh, God, not hilarious that you thought someone was coming to get you, obviously, but I mean that it might be me.
He fumbles to a stop. I know what he meant, and to be honest, I'm so pleased he's here he could literally say anything right now. I smile.
Well, then maybe you shouldn't be creeping around outside people's houses like a murderer, Chris.
Yeah, I definitely need to stop doing that, he smiles mutedly before his expression drops slightly. But someone did ring you to let you know I was coming, right?
Yeah, I literally just got off the phone with Pete.
With someone. I catch myself. I'm not sure if I should be mentioning Peter at this stage. I know he's in close contact with the police, but I don't know if it's above Chris's pay grade. I move on swiftly. They said someone would be coming. I just didn't know you'd get here so quickly. But Chris catches my misstep.
Who called you, Marn?
He asks, suddenly serious. I rub my eyes. I'm so tired.
Please stop calling me Marn, Chris. I haven't been Marn for years, and it's none of your business who called me, okay? That's confidential.
I regret my tone instantly when I see his expression. I'm sorry, Emma. I'm sorry about all of this, the press finding out. I didn't know Zara would do this. She threw me out this morning, by the way, so I don't know. She thinks we're having some kind of affair. He shakes his head dismissively as if the thought were beyond absurd. Anyway, I'm just saying that I'm not sure whoever you're working for really has your best interests at heart. I mean, they could have moved you somewhere safer than this for a start, couldn't they?
What do you mean she threw you out?
Don't change the subject, Emma.
What was the subject? What? Why I'm staying here, in the middle of nowhere?
Well, for a start, they wanted to keep me away from Holt. I reply indignantly. The mention of Holt silences him, and when I look back, he's intent on my foot again. I sigh and fall back into the cushions.
I'm sorry, Chris. I've just got a lot going on in my head right now.
He tugs, and another spike of glass pulls painfully free.
Are you scared about what will happen tomorrow?
I close my eyes and blow out a soft breath as he pinches another shard out.
Yes, I am. I'm very scared. For my mother, what she'll wake up to in the morning. For Joe and how he'll have to pull Chloe from her daycare. I'm scared for all of them waking up to reporters on their doorsteps and it being my fault that their friends won't look at them in the same way again. And I'm terrified of the questions and of the judgment.
It won't be as bad as before, I don't think. It can't be.
Chris, have you seen those TV crews outside the hospital? The world is a totally different place than it was 14 years ago. Everything is bigger, faster, meaner. This time it will be everywhere.
You know, if it makes you feel any better, I didn't read about it at the time. It seemed wrong to read about your personal life like that. They shouldn't have released some of the things they did. I'm sorry that happened.
He wipes both feet with an alcohol wipe and presses on a final bandage.
All done here, Dr. Lewis?
He throws me one of his ridiculously handsome smiles, gives my ankles a warm squeeze, his skin on mine. All the blood in my body rushes up my inner thighs. Oh, God. Every natural impulse tells me to pull away from his hands, but his touch feels so good. My body bypasses my brain.
Would you like a glass of wine, Chris? I know you're on duty, but one won't hurt, right?
He holds my gaze, eyes crinkling around the edges.
No, it wouldn't. And yes, I would.
I pull on the socks he passes me and hobble off on tender, plaster-covered feet to the kitchen. The evening passes in a blur of sensations, the hot flush of wine through us, his smiling eyes taking in my face, a burst of laughter, his hand resting on my thigh in its electric throb of possibility, and then suddenly, his warm mouth on mine. The feel of his hands all over me as we kiss, the desperate animal need of it. Later, I offer him the second bedroom, but he says he'll sleep on the sofa. He's supposed to be on duty anyway, and I head upstairs to bed. I lie there, awake, thinking about what happened that night 14 years ago. I didn't see my father do it. Maybe that's half the problem, or maybe it's the silver lining. I heard it, though. The crack of it in the night, like thunder. The rip of the double-barreled shotgun as it echoed up the thick carpet of our staircase, along the landing lined with our family pictures, and into my childhood bedroom. But before the echo of the gunshot, there was the helicopter. The noise of it circling in tight loops over the house was what woke me. I'd sat up in bed, groggy, blinking into the shadows, as it rumbled over the house, my head throbbing. A headache and nausea from too much sugar and excitement at the fireworks that evening. After a moment, Joe trundled into my room too, his silhouette in my doorway. "Helicopter," he said croakily, as the mechanical roar receded off into the night.
"Yeah,"
I offered up into the growing quiet, the noise gone as quickly as it came. Joe disappears to his room, and I lie back down with a wave of dizziness, and pull my duvet up to my chin. Safe. And the sharp scent of spent fireworks in the air. I think of the bonfire earlier that night, of nice things, of being cold and now being warm. Snapshots of memories. Dad's concentrated face as he lit the sparklers, Mum's smile, crunch of teeth on burnt caramel, the rush of sugar through my body. Watching the giant pyre as flecks of gold and orange crackle and float away into the darkness. Caught half awake, half dreaming, a half dream where I rise from bed. Voices in the hallway. I come out onto the landing and see him, my father, pulling on his coat. He's leaving. He sees me standing bleary at the top of the stairs.
"Where are you going, Dad?"
I ask.
"Nowhere, honey. Go back to bed," he tells me, smiling softly.
"But I don't feel well," I tell him.
"It's okay, baby. You'll feel better in the morning,"
he reassures me and blows me a kiss, and I smile back for Daddy and go to bed. I wake up when the helicopter roars overhead again, louder this time, lower. I sit bolt upright, a terror crystallizing in my adolescent brain. Something is wrong. Joe scrambles back into my room, skidding over to the bedroom window, disappearing behind the thick silk of the curtains, only his feet visible below.
"What is it, Joe?"
I rasp,
my throat dry. I really don't feel well. The rhythmic thud of helicopter blades thumps through the night air. No answer from my brother. My curiosity is piqued, and I race into the gap between the curtains to join him as the big machine hovers overhead a third time. I catch the flash of its floodlights as it sweeps low over our wet roof, blinding light and noise, the word police emblazoned across its underbelly. Transfixed, my brother and I watch as it slowly lowers and touches down in our top field, the long grass around it whipping with the downforce of the blades. We stare out the rain-speckled window as the helicopter doors burst open and uniformed officers jump out and run towards our house. And then it comes from downstairs. The noise. Crack. A rip of sound. A gunshot, loud and horrifyingly distinct, cracking through the silent house. My breath catches in my throat, and I drop straight to the floor as if somehow I'm the one who's been shot. Terror coursing through me, pure animalistic fear. Real gunshots aren't like the ones on TV. You feel the sound in your body. It hits you. It's a sound you'd recognize even if you hadn't grown up around it. A sound and a meaning in one. An instant understanding of events. No further shots. Just ringing silence through the house. And the knowledge of what that means. Outside, we hear shouts getting closer to the house. I look across to Joe, crouched next to me on the carpet, his head buried, his pyjamas and the carpet around him wet with urine, his body quivering. I make the first move, an animal instinct to find my dad. I scramble as fast as I can, low on all fours across the bedroom floor and onto the thick carpet of the landing. A light is on downstairs. Through the banisters, I see Mum, leaning on the study doorframe, her hand to her mouth. She's staring at something. The burst of breaking glass from the front of the house, voices shouting. I don't know why, but I run. I run to him, down the stairs, past Mum's outstretched, grasping hands, through a doorway I won't ever be able to come back through. And I find him there, in his study. His face and the back of his skull gone. Or rather, displaced. Pieces of it. Of him. Stuck in the curtains. Hot globules and bone chip on the window's latticework. Wet drips and chunks in and on his precious books. His whole life broken open across the upholstery. On his desk, four cream envelopes, splattered. Thick watermarked paper. His letters to us inside. One addressed to Marty Fenshaw, Dad's solicitor. One to Joe. One to Mum. And one to me. I don't know why he wrote them. Guilt, maybe. Either way, I wouldn't read mine for another 2 years. I stand and stare at what he's done. Dizzy. My head pounding and the sound of Mum's gasping breath behind me. The shotgun now propped between two lifeless thighs, his dark blood creeping slowly and steadily across the sanded oak floorboards towards us. The room spins around us, and I can no longer stop the nausea from rising. I vomit hot, sharp bile forwards onto the floor. And suddenly there are police everywhere, swarming into the house through the front and back. Later, I will see the squad cars filling our drive, the riot van next to Mum's 4x4. They're shouting, but we don't hear their words as they pour in, fully armed. We find out later they'd come to seize Dad's hard drive, his papers, before he destroyed them. They'd come to take him in. But he's beaten them to it. He's destroyed everything, and he's already gone. We'd find out later that he'd embezzled hundreds of thousands of pounds from charitable funds, that he'd misappropriated funds meant for the survivors of the London bombings, other people's money, victims' money, and we'd never find that money. We'd find out in the emergency room that the headaches and the vomiting we were all experiencing were due to gas poisoning. Dad had disabled the pilot light on the oven. He'd put out the flame, and the house had slowly been filling with gas for hours while we slept, the bitter smell of it permeating every room of the house. They said at the inquest he meant to take us all with him. A last-minute idea, they speculated. Otherwise, why would he have bothered to write us all notes? Why indeed? After 2 years of waiting, I found that mine said only, "Marnie Marn, I love you. I hope one day you'll be able to understand. Your dad." Understand what? He thought we'd be better off dead than without him. That's what he had decided for us, that we were his property to dispose of in any way he liked. We weren't meant to read those letters. He wrote them for our dead bodies. We were all meant to go in our sleep, but he ran out of time and shot himself first. Except, I don't think he did. I don't think the man with no face in the study was my father, which I would later tell the police and social workers. I saw him put his coat on, I'd tell them. I saw him leave the house. He told me to go back to bed. Whoever that person was in the study, they weren't my father. That body wasn't wearing a coat. You never found his coat. They tell me it was a hallucination from the gas poisoning. They tell me they'd done a DNA test on the remains. They tell me to stop. But someone believed me. The press believed me. And at first I was glad at least someone did. But they wanted to know if he wasn't dead. Where had he gone? They demanded to know where he'd gone with all that money. They wanted to track him down and make him pay. And they just wouldn't stop asking. Even after I told the police I believed them, that I must have imagined seeing him. Even after I told everyone I'd made a mistake, they kept asking, and then they got angry, and it became dangerous. That's when we had to leave. I know logically I didn't see him, that logically I couldn't have seen him leave, but I did, didn't I? Shards of memory from that night, recalled over and over and over. Blood everywhere. I stare at it transfixed. Mum crouched on the floor, her mouth open in a silent scream, spit stringing straight down onto our floorboards, her eyes searching the approaching faces of police for some kind of answer as to why. They pull her roughly backwards, like a rag doll she lets herself be carried off, no resistance. Something soft and helpless in a sea of uniforms. The world slows right down as they pour into the study around me, finally blocking my view. As I've said, nobody becomes a psychiatrist by accident. Chapter 35. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 12. Repercussions. Officer Graceford arrives at 7 a.m, bringing the stack of newspapers I'd requested through Chris. Not yet ready to face the TV coverage, I pore over the papers with my bandaged hands as Chris finishes cooking us breakfast. He wouldn't take no for an answer after calling a company to replace the glass in the basement window. Graceford eyes the apron he's wearing over his uniform and turns back to me briskly. "I'll be covering you at the hospital if you want to go back in today," she explains. "If you don't feel up to it, you can stay here in the lodge with Chris until things calm down. It's totally up to you." She smiles understandingly, and I want to hug her for her lack of judgment either way. "I'll have to think about it." She nods and throws a look back to Chris, his hair still rumpled from sleep. "I'll be keeping an eye on things at the hospital, Chris. Radio me if anything changes here." "Will do," he says, trying to remain dignified while holding a spatula. After Graceford leaves, I take a deep breath and flick on the TV. Footage of my face. Me walking out of the hospital, furtive, guilty, though of what, I do not know. I guess I have a guilty face. The news anchors talk about me, about Dad.
The daughter of the late Charles Beaufort, who was estimated to have misappropriated approximately £875,000 from the 7th of July victims charity, as well as other sums from various sources, re-emerged yesterday after 14 years in hiding. Marnie Beaufort, now Dr. Emma Lewis, has been working within the NHS under an assumed name.
Bloody hell. They make it sound like I'm pretending to be a doctor.
News sources yesterday uncovered that Marnie Beaufort is currently the lead specialist on another case garnering public interest. The mysterious case of Mr. Nobody, the unknown man found wandering a beach in Norfolk, close to Dr. Lewis's own childhood home. Although currently not under investigation, Marnie Beaufort was believed by many during the 2005 inquest into Charles Beaufort's misappropriation of funds and subsequent death to be involved in a cover-up surrounding his suicide. Several sources at the time of the investigation expressed concerns that the body discovered in the Beaufort family home may not have been that of Charles Beaufort, and that Charles Beaufort may well still be at large. However, DNA samples analysed at the scene and during the subsequent police investigation did match with that of Mr. Beaufort.
I feel Chris's eyes on me. I sense his concern. I can almost hear his thoughts. Do I think he's still alive too? That's what he wants to know. That's what everyone wants to know. Two questions over and over. Do I think he's still alive? And where is the money? I avoid Chris's gaze and focus on the images as they flash up on the screen. Footage from 2005. Shots of a 16-year-old me cowed by the attention, my terrified expression as alert as a wounded animal's. Shots of the July 7th bombings. Interviews with victims about the money he stole. I flip the channel. A floppy-haired man in a navy blazer holds forth.
Yes, that's all very well, Susanna, but what if Charles Beaufort is still alive and out there somewhere, living off all this stolen money he's accrued? I just think, with today's technology, it's worth looking at the evidence again. What harm could it do? If he's dead, he's dead. All I'm saying is I think it might be worth the police reopening the case. There were contradictory facts. The daughter saw him leave the house. That was in her original statement. It was only afterwards the story changed. I definitely think it's worth another look.
The female presenter gives him an incredulous yet indulgent look.
But come on, Jeremy. Didn't he attempt to murder the whole family? Why would any of them be helping him get away with that? They'd have to be mad. Actually, not really. If you think about it, then it makes perfect sense. The carbon monoxide levels in the house were high, but nowhere near fatal. It may have been part of the ruse. Get the family in on it. If he'd really wanted to kill them all, it could have just increased the flow. And he had a gun, didn't he?
Jesus Christ. I flip the channel. This is going to be worse than last time. Now that I'm over 18, all bets are off. I'm fair game. They think I know where he is. They think I helped him. They think I'm protecting a man who stole from grieving families and tried to kill me and my whole family. But do I think he's alive? No. Yes. The real truth? I don't know. Because I saw him go. I know they told me it was a hallucination. I know about the DNA test results. I know about the evidence. I know, and yet, the body in the study wasn't wearing his jacket. It didn't feel like him. It just didn't. And I don't know where he is or where the money is, and I don't know the whys of any of it, but do I think he's still alive? Yes. I think of Matthew in his hospital room, and I can't help but wonder if locked away inside him is some kind of answer. On the next TV station, one of the bombing survivors speaks to the camera.
Who exactly paid for this woman's medical training? That's what I'd like to know. Isn't it a bit convenient that all this money disappeared and she shows up 14 years later a doctor? We should be asking where the money for that came from. Why haven't the police followed up on that?
Chris, who has come up behind me unnoticed, gently takes the remote from my tight grip and turns off the blaring screen. I realise I haven't blinked for a while. And it feels strange to do so now. He pulls me in close to him and I let him. It feels so good to be held. "Call your family," he whispers gently. "Let them know you're okay." I call Joe. It's a brief conversation. His voice is tight, and it's blindingly obvious that I should have followed his advice on Friday, although he does me the extraordinary kindness of not bringing that up. "He's going straight to Mum's," he tells me. "She's seen the news. Apparently there are already people outside her house." I feel awful. The guilt is almost too much to bear, and even though it feels ridiculous to be giving my brother advice, I feel obliged to give him the same warning Peter gave me. "Don't talk to anyone, Joe. Don't answer the phone, unless you know who it is first." I want to call Mum, but I can't. The guilt is too sharp. I don't think I'd be able to hold it together. And I definitely don't want her to feel she needs to reassure me. God, I don't think I could handle her being brave for me. I text her that I love her and I'm sorry, and I leave it at that. At 8 a.m, Peter calls.
"Listen, Emma, we're happy to accept your resignation. If you're not up to continuing, we completely understand. The press attention is fairly unprecedented, and given the circumstances, if you'd rather take some time for yourself to be with your family..."
I thought a lot about it this morning, about what Peter might say when he rang. Why on earth did they choose me in the first place? Why did they want such a media liability hanging over their heads? It occurs to me that I still don't know who Peter works for. I don't even know that much. It's entirely possible that I'm here to deliberately make people look bad, that that's my whole purpose. Because how convenient for some if this whole situation were to become a media disaster. Wouldn't that be perfect? Wouldn't a series of monumental blunders before the election season be just the sort of thing that might serve certain people very well? A government scandal, an immigration scare, and good old-fashioned healthcare.